For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
So, what we're going to do, we're going to follow the general train of thought through this long, you know, 50 verse vision or more, but we're not going to be able to take it verse by verse. We're going to hit the high points, the important parts. And I want to also take some time to look at parallel other tribulation passages that have to do with this last period of human history when things really come to a climax that Jesus called the Great Tribulation. And then we'll see if we can patch together kind of a potential scenario for what we know about the last war of the world called Armageddon. All right, before we do any of that, we have to finish last week. We didn't do we were in Daniel 9. We had the 77s, and we ended on this verse where after the 62 sevens, so there were seven sevens and 62 sevens, and after that, so there's 69, the Messiah would be cut off, the Messiah would be killed. And so we're missing a seven. We've only got 69 here, supposed to be 77s. And he says, the people of the prince who is to come will destroy the city and the sanctuary. Okay, so as he's getting this, the city of Jerusalem's already wasted. But the angel said, you're going to go back and rebuild it, the decree to rebuild Jerusalem. Now it's going to get wasted again by this outfit. Notice that it's the people of the prince who is to come, not that it's the prince who is to come. Who were the people that destroyed Jerusalem? This was fulfilled in 70 AD by the Romans. So the Romans are the people of the prince who is to come. Got to keep our language very clear here. That kind of becomes important later. The city, they destroy the city and the sanctuary. That's the rebuilt temple that's going to be rebuilt. And that happened. That's already happened about 30, 40 years after Jesus lived. Its end will come with a flood. I think a flood of, it's a rushing flood of soldiers that he's talking about. Even to the end, there will be war and desolations are determined. Even to the end. So here, maybe we have, this might be like the fast forward, you know, where we have kind of zoomed ahead in history here, because the next thing you know, we come to the next verse, 27. He will confirm a covenant with the many for 1 7. There's our missing seven right there. Okay, so who is he here? The nearest predecessor is the prince who is to come. So there's the people of the prince who is to come, and then he makes a covenant with the many. That's with the Jewish people. And so it's a dude, and it's him. It's the beast. It's the same guy that showed up repeatedly in Daniel. Look what happens. In the middle of the seven, he will put an end to sacrifice and offering. Okay, seven divided by two, 3.5. That came up earlier, remember? 3.5 years, that's exactly named in several passages. We looked at Revelation, had him for 42 months, had him for 1,260 days, had him for time, times and half a time. It's 3.5 years here. It's half of the seven, 3.5 and 3.5. This last 7-year period, it's the period called the tribulation. And this explains, too, why when we read about the tribulation, part of it is described as peaceful, not so much for believers, but for everyone else. And it says they're crying peace and safety, like, oh, we finally made it. We finally got a world order. We're safe. And then they suddenly fracture and go back to war again. So the second half of the tribulation, full of warfare, catastrophic slaughter everywhere. Whereas the first half is relatively peaceful, but under the dominion of this government. Okay, he puts an end to sacrifice and offering. How can you have grain offering and sacrifice when the temple just was already destroyed in the previous verse? Right? If you know anything about Judaism, they cannot offer sacrifices anywhere except in that temple. And that's a strict rule in the Old Testament. You can't do it in your backyard. And yet, so obviously the temple must be back. And obviously this signals that we have, that was a fast forward. We did jump from the first coming of Christ to the second coming. From the, it's like most of these prophetic gaps. And obviously the cue is there. I mean, if you're paying attention, you can see that this is, we clearly have moved from ancient times to something that still hasn't even happened. There's still no temple there. So this is still in the future. And the wing of a temple, he will set up an abomination that causes desolation until the end is decreed, is poured out on him. This abomination of desolation, it's a technical Jewish term that has to do with desecrating the temple and like a particularly outlandish way. And Jesus, Paul, and Daniel all associate this abomination of desolation as an important event linked to the end times. Here's Jesus. When you see the abomination of desolation spoken of through Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, let the reader understand, see? And flee to the mountains, he says, for then there will be a great tribulation such as not occurred since the beginning of the world till now, nor ever will. That's where we get the term, the tribulation, from Jesus. And unless those days had been cut short, no life would have been saved. But for the sake of the elect, those days will be cut short. Well, I don't know, as an ancient reader, how would you think that all life on earth could be destroyed when people are still poking each other with spears? You know, it's unimaginable. And yet here's another one of these cases where we're reading something that must have sounded insane to ancient ears. But then we read that and we're like, oh my God, that could totally happen. That's the world in which we live. No life saved. Well, so there you have Daniel 9, the 70th week. It's part of the allocation to your people. Because when the angel came to Daniel, he says, 70 sevenths have been given to your people. This is a Jewish dominated period. The spiritual focus is going to be among the Jewish people again, like it was in the Old Testament times. It's associated with the beast. It's associated with the abomination of desolation. It's divided in halves, 3.5 and 3.5 years. And that may account for the different descriptions we hear. Different, the first half and the second half are very different in that tribulation. So we're ready to go to the last vision. I'm not going to read chapter 10. Basically, in chapter 10, Daniel is praying to God, and again, an angel comes to visit him. It's Gabriel. And he says, I've come to explain your questions. And this is what he says. We'll start in 11. Gabriel says, in the first year of Darius the Mede, I rose to be an encouragement and a protection for him. And now I'm going to tell you the truth. Behold, there are three more kings are going to arise in Persia. This is so Darius, the first year of Darius, we're right at the beginning of the Persian Empire again. This must be very close in time to the previous vision in chapter 9. And he says, three more kings, and then a fourth king will gain far more riches than all of them. As soon as he becomes strong through his riches, he will arouse the whole empire against the realm of Greece. It's Xerxes. It's the guy that invaded Greece and the 300 Spartans. Yeah, this is him, obviously. And a mighty king will arise, and he will rule with great authority and do as he pleases. But as soon as he has arisen, his kingdom will be broken and parceled out toward the four points of the compass, though not to his own descendants, nor to his authority which he wielded, for his sovereignty will be uprooted and given to others besides him. If you've been here the past few weeks, you already know who this is, right? Obviously, Alexander the Great, the guy who counterattacked the Persians, destroyed them, the king that grew with mighty authority, but who, as soon as he was had risen, was uprooted and died. It's Alexander. Died at a very young age, right as he had conquered all the way across to India. And his soldiers wouldn't go any further. They were like, we're tired of this. So they went back and partied, and that's where he died. No sooner had he conquered that empire than he died. Then later, his four generals parsed it up into those four kingdoms. In this vision, the focus is on one of those. It's mainly the two eastern, Ptolemy and Seleucus, and their wars with each other. And this, the rest of this vision focuses on that. It gets very specific, detailed. There are, according to John Wolford, counted up 130 some predictions in this vision that came to pass in the Seleucid Empire. And it's so detailed that, of course, an important point to know here is that all readers, including skeptical, non-believing readers, agree that this is describing a detailed sequence of historical events in that ancient Near Eastern area. And obviously, in the mind of the skeptical readers, this proves that Daniel was written after these events because he knows about them. And of course, that would be inevitable. You would have to say that. Didn't really help Daniel 9, though, did it? Anyway, we're not going to go through this detail unless you're interested and fascinated by ancient Near Eastern history. There's just too much detail to cover here, and we're going to jump down to verse 29, where our buddy reappears, the eighth ruler in that Seleucid dynasty. This is him right here at the appointed time. He'll invade the south again. The south is Ptolemy in Egypt. The north is Seleucus, the Seleucid dynasty, and right now occupied by this Antiochus IV. He is the guy who we saw in chapter 8 also committed an abomination of desolation. And for that reason, he is linked to the future guy that does it, the beast. He's like a type, a symbol. He's typologically linked to that later figure because of the similar things they do. The persecution of the people of God. The hatred of God, the effort to abomination. This guy slew swine in the temple of God and stood up a statue of Zeus in the sanctuary at the temple. Yeah, you can just imagine the agony that devout Jews would feel from that. But when Jesus spoke and said, when you see the abomination of desolation, this was already past history to him. This happened around 171, 167 BC. So Jesus is not talking about this guy, but he's talking about the guy this guy symbolizes, the guy mentioned in chapter 9. In fact, chapter 9 is the only place where that abomination of desolation is mentioned, and that hasn't actually happened already. And it shows that we're interpreting Daniel 9 correctly, according to Jesus. He mentions in verse 30 that ships of the western coastlands will oppose him and he will lose heart. Well-known event in history. This is brought up by Jewish historian Josephus and also by Livy. It talks about how the Roman consul Gaius Popilius Lanus met Antiochus says he was coming with an army toward Alexandria in Egypt. And this is where we get the story of drawing a line in the sand. And he told him, if you come any further, you are at war with Rome. Because Rome decided we have to protect our grain. They were getting their grain supplies from Egypt. And he says, we're not going to accept you coming in here. And so Antiochus was stalling for time. And Linnaeus took his cane and drew a line around him. And he said, before you step outside of that circle, you better have an answer. Yes or no. Well, Antiochus didn't want to mess with Rome. Even though they weren't in this part of the world yet, they were in the Western Mediterranean, well known to be mighty tough. He didn't want to mess with that. He retreated back out of Egypt. And he was furious, and he vented his fury against the Holy Covenant, the people of God, and showed favor to those who forsake the Holy Covenant. This is when his persecution of the Jews began. He decided to try to stomp out the worship of Yahweh and to compel everyone to worship Greek deities, the Greek pantheon, Zeus, Apollos, et al. And so this is what triggered the Maccabean revolt. The history of this period you can read in 1st and 2nd Maccabees. And eventually they won and got their freedom. But at this point, his armed forces will rise and desecrate the temple fortress. It will abolish the daily sacrifice. They'll set up the abomination that causes desolation. There it is again. This guy doing it way back in 167 BC is when this happened, with the swine and the statue and all that stuff. And again, now, so we have linked, even though this is in the past tense, we have linked to the type, to the anti-type, who is also does the same thing. Some of the wise will stumble so that they may be refined, purified, and made spotless until the time of the end, for it still will come at the appointed time. And so again, here's our cue that we're jumping from Antiochus, the type, to the beast, the anti-type. And it's a prophetic gap. It's a prophetic gap. From 36 on, everything up to this point has already happened. From this point on, none of it's happened. There are at least seven reasons why we can see that there is a prophetic gap at verse 36. And I don't know whether I put numberings on them, but we'll just pick them out as we go through. Right here, already, it's a new title. He has been calling him the Despicable One, and now he calls him the King. Or he also calls him the King of the North. Now he just calls him the King. He will exalt and magnify himself above every god and will say unheard of things against the God of gods. He will be successful until the time of wrath is completed, for what has been determined must take place. Exalting himself and magnifying himself above every god, something that Antiochus did not do. It wasn't a statue of himself that he put in a temple. It was a statue of Zeus. He was loyal to the Greek gods. He did call himself a manifestation of God, and in that sense, the arrogance to kind of have a divine nature was there, but he doesn't fit this description, whereas the beast does. He is over every other religion and declares himself to be the true God. And to do this and to repeat that abomination of desolation, you have to have the temple has to be rebuilt. He will show no regard for the gods of his fathers or for the desire of women, nor will he regard any god, but will exalt himself above them all. That totally does not fit Antiochus. He was never denied the gods of his fathers. He loyally followed them. But the beast, on the other hand, yeah. And he exalts himself above them all. It reminds us in Revelation 13, remember we read this about the beast, and they worshiped the dragon because he gave his authority to the beast. So the beast actually becomes a cult where people worship this dude. They're convinced. Paul also talks about the same event in the book of 2 Thessalonians in the New Testament. He's talking to them about how somebody told them the tribulation already started. He's like, that's not true. He says, it will not, let no one in any way deceive you. It will not come unless the apostasy comes first and the man of lawlessness is revealed, the son of destruction. That's him, the beast. Who, he says, exalts himself above every so-called god or object of worship so that he takes his seat in the temple of God displaying himself as being God. That's the abomination of desolation that he performs. It's a little different than the one that Antiochus did, but really super bad news, clearly. Instead of them, you know, he's called Antichrist. And it may not be Antichrist in the sense that he's against Christ, but tupos and anti-tupos in the sense that he matches Christ, that he corresponds to Christ. He may claim that he's Christ. It's entirely possible that this guy is going to try to sell people on the idea that he's a return of Jesus Christ. And in that sense, that's why people worship him. They think he's God incarnate. Instead, he will honor a God of fortresses, a God unknown to his fathers. I don't know exactly what this means, but it kind of reminds you, this part that we just read, they worship the dragon, and then it says, they say, who is like the beast and who is able to wage war with him? It's the military power, the overwhelming power that the beast has that people just roll over. They're just like, they don't want to face up to him. It's too strong. Remember, he's at the head of that Western coalition that could involve the United States. We could be a part of that. He will attack the mightiest fortresses with the help of a foreign god and will greatly honor those who acknowledge him. He'll make them rulers over many people and will distribute land at a price. You can sense that he's really in charge, just like the other ones we're talking about, and making changes in the calendar, the way things work worldwide. And then at 40, at the time of the end, so here again, we're clearly at the end times. The king of the south will engage him in battle, and the king of the north will storm and get out against him with chariots, cavalry, and a great fleet of ships. He'll invade many countries and sweep through them like a flood. Okay, here we find, so one reason that this is one of our seven reasons, it's at the end times, which is not when Antiochus lived. Also, the king of the north will storm against him. But earlier in this passage, Antiochus is the king of the north. So he's attacking himself here. And we can see, again, we've changed to a different time framework. Invading countries, this is beginning the narrative of the last world war. And we see him passing through multiple countries. It ends up in the Near East, but there are many other countries involved, as you can see right here. And remember that, I'll bring this back up in a few minutes. He will also invade the beautiful land, Israel. Many countries will fall, but Edom, Moab, and the leaders of Ammon will be delivered from his hand. These are areas to the east and south of Israel that are very barren, desertous, and those areas escape damage. People will believe that when Jesus said to flee to the hills, that's where he said people should go, to avoid this cataclysm. He'll extend his power over many countries. Egypt will not escape. He'll gain control of the treasures of gold and silver, all the riches of Egypt, with the Libyans and Nubians in submission. So that's a North African campaign. But reports from the east and the north will alarm him, and he will set out in a great rage to destroy and annihilate many. So that's back from where he is in North Africa. That would be back into the Middle East. He'll pitch his royal tents between the seas and the beautiful holy mountain, Mount Zion, Jerusalem. So he's really at Tel Aviv here, is where he's going to base his headquarters. And yet he will come to his end and no one will help him. Well, the next verse is actually 12 verse 1. And remember, all the chapter divisions, all of the verses don't belong there. They were never a part of it until the 1500s AD. And some of them come in really bizarre places. So ignore those. And notice that the time framework, now at that time. So this is specifically at the time. There's another reason why that must be a prophetic gap there. Michael, the great prince, he's an angel who stands guard over the sons of your people, will arise. And there will be a time of distress such as has never occurred since there was a nation until that time. And at that time, your people, everyone found written in the book of life, will be rescued. See the language of the great distress? He calls it a distress, like Jesus called it a tribulation, like nothing any nations had before. It's definitely the same thing. And so the beast gets wiped out, and that corresponds with the second coming of Christ and the end of history as we know it. Yeah, that language right there. And people, though, that follow Christ are going to get rescued. Physically, probably, rescued out of this churning warfare that's destroying so many people. Okay, let's read a couple of other narratives, because remember how we talked about the parallel narratives align up, and then you see the identical features being mentioned. You can kind of meld them together, and you get a scenario, a matrix of prophetic prediction. This is in another book, Ezekiel, written earlier than Daniel's passage, Ezekiel 38 and 9. The word of the Lord, Ezekiel's a different prophet. The word of the Lord came to me and said, "Son of man, set your face against Gog in the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshach and Tubal, and prophesy against him. Say, this is what the sovereign Lord says. I'm against you, O Gog, the chief prince of Meshach and Tubal." Okay, ancient Jewish historian Josephus says that these tribal groups are Scythians. And so do a couple of other rabbis from that period. That was their understanding. Scythia is southern Russia and the Caucasus. It could be Russia. It could be former Soviet republics like Azerbaijan, Georgia, Ukraine. Hard to say any of those down in that southern area in the steppe land of Russia. And he also is described later in this chapter and the next as being from the farthest north. So when you go from, this is written from the perspective of Israel, you go straight north and it goes almost down to downtown Moscow. So yeah, someone up in that region. Maybe, I'm not sure whether we should correlate this battle with the one that Daniel refers to. There is an argument that it's not the same, that it's a different one. And or maybe it is the same. It definitely seems to happen at the end of human history or near to it. And Daniel referred to the king of the north storming against the beast. Maybe these guys to the uttermost north of Israel, maybe that's the king of the north right there. And he goes on, Persia, Cush, and Put will be with them, all with shields and helmets. Well, that's Persia. These are Near Eastern and North African powers. So this could be a coalition. That could be the kings of the south that storm against him as well. And maybe that it sounds like they're allied with Gog and Magog. So this is a coordinated attack, and it's headed toward Israel. Also Gomer with all his troops, Beth Togarma from the far north with all of his troops, many nations with you. So it's a big war, big attack. After many days, you'll be summoned. In the latter years, so we're at the end of history, you will come into the land that is restored from the sword, whose inhabitants had been gathered from many nations to the mountains of Israel, which had been a continual waste, but his people were brought out from the nations, and they're living securely, all of them. Well, if you were here a couple weeks back, we talked about that astonishing cluster of predictions that Israel is going to be scattered over to all nations, and then after a long time are going to be regathered back into their nation. Here's another one. We didn't read this one at the time. You can see that there are in many nations regathered. And they're living securely and at peace. So it makes it sound like the originator of this war is Gog and Magog. They launch it against a peaceful land. On that day, you will say, I will invade a land of unwalled villages. I'll attack a peaceful, unsuspecting people, all of them living without walls and without gates and bars. And therefore, son of man, prophesy and say to Gog, this is what the sovereign Lord says. In my zeal and fiery wrath, I declare that at the time there shall be a great earthquake in the land of Israel. The fish of the sea, the birds of the air, the beasts of the field, and every creature that moves on the ground, all the people on the face of the earth will tremble at my presence. Mountains will be overturned. Cliffs will crumble. Every wall will fall to the ground. Holy crap, that is not a normal earthquake. This great worldwide earthquake that's like nothing that ever happened before is mentioned repeatedly in these narratives, and that becomes like a time mark that you can align with the other ones. I'll show you in a minute. Anyway, he says you're going to lose this fight. And I'll summon a sword. Every man's sword will be against his brother, confusion. And I will execute judgment upon him with plague and bloodshed. I will pour down torrents of rain, hailstone, fire, and brimstone on him and on his troops and on the many nations with him. Well, that's not a normal hailstorm either. What is fire and brimstone doing in the middle of a hailstorm? That doesn't happen. But this could be phenomenological language. We're not even sure this is an earthquake that happens. It could be that what is happening here is nuclear war. And that it's shaking everything. And he's seeing buildings collapse and, you know, the roaring, shaking. And using his language to describe what he sees like a movie, you know, what is it? It's like an earthquake. That it could be the case in a number of these passages. Here are several from Revelation where we may be dealing with what we call phenomenological language or perspectival language. So he sees, you know, a bomb coming down and exploding. They'd never seen explosives before. They've never seen a bomb come out of this. Things don't come out of the sky other than maybe like hailstones come out of the sky. But so he's going to try to use terms that they're familiar with and that he's familiar with and try to describe it. See if you think that's what this is. This is in Revelation 8. One of the angels sounds his trumpet and there came hail and fire mixed with blood. And they were thrown to the earth and a third of the earth was burned up. And a third of the trees were burned up and all the green grass was burned up. Okay, again, hail and fire mixed with blood, and a third of the earth burned. Hailstorms don't do that. They're very localized. Maybe he's just seeing things coming down out of the sky and fire and reddish fire, and it burns up a third of the earth. Here's another one. The second angel sounded, and something like a great mountain burning with fire was thrown into the sea, and a third of the sea became blood. A third of the creatures which were in the sea had life, died, and a third of the ships were destroyed. Something like a great mountain burning with fire. It's a volcano, right? Now, they had seen that. They had seen fire coming out of the sea. He doesn't say it is a volcano. He says it's something like that. Something that's on fire hits the ocean and boom, blows away a third of the ships in the ocean. Here's another one. Third angel sounded. And a great star fell from heaven, burning like a torch. And it fell on a third of the rivers and springs of waters. And the name of the star is called Wormwood. And a third of the waters became wormwood. It's a term they use for poison, undrinkable water. And many men died from the waters because they were made bitter. Okay, so it's burning like a torch, something on fire coming down, and boom, boom, boom. Maybe it is. Maybe it's a natural phenomenon. It could be. Like an asteroid blow or something like that could cause this kind of damage that we're talking about. But in the context of the narratives where we're reading it, the context is war. And so I think it's very possible that we're actually reading an ancient person's effort to describe a futuristic war. Here's one more in chapter 16, verse 16, just to get the context. They gathered all of the nations together to the place which in Hebrew is called Armageddon. That's it. That's where we get the term Armageddon, right there. It's the valley below the mountain and valley below Megiddo, a city in northern Israel. And this basin is about 20 miles across the narrow way and like 60 miles, 50 or 60 miles the long way. Huge basins, not like a little valley. And that is apparently, well, I'll hit you with some speculation on that in a minute. But listen to what happens when they get there. He says, there were flashes of lightning, sounds and peals of thunder, and a great earthquake, such as there has not been since man came under the earth. So great an earthquake it was, and so mighty. And huge hailstones, about 100 pounds each, came down from heaven upon men, and men blasphemed God because of the plague of the hail, because this plague was extremely severe. See? Hailstones, about 100 pounds each. Are you kidding? Hailstones don't get anywhere near that big. But I mean, again, he sees large objects coming down, peals of thunder, lightning. This is exactly what you would expect. And then this earthquake, there's our buddy, the earthquake, like no other earthquake that ever happened. The crap lines up. Let's go to another narrative in Isaiah. I think he might be using this phenomenological language also. This is in 13. People will be terrified. Pains and anguish will take hold of them. They will writhe like a woman in labor. They will look at one another in astonishment, their faces aflame. He says, I will make mortal man scarcer than pure gold, and mankind more scarce than the gold of Ophir. Therefore, I'll make the heavens tremble, and the earth will shake from its place. And then there's our shaking, our quaking. There's humans becoming rare. If you found a gold nugget somewhere, that's how likely it would be that you would find a live human being. This is really bad. In 24, he talks about the inhabitants of the earth are burned and few are left. Interestingly, in both of these, people are meeting their death through being burned, which was not the case in ancient warfare. Very rare. They had some fire weapons, mostly used naval and at sea, sometimes in breaking a sea, trying to besiege a city. Really, people did not burn to death. They got cut and stabbed to death, clubbed to death. But in this one, people are burned. It's fire. The earth is broken asunder. The earth is split through. The earth is shaken violently. The earth reels to and fro like a drunk. And it totters like a shack, for its transgression is heavy upon it, and it will fall, never to rise again. Looks like it could be our buddy the earthquake once again there, doesn't it? Let's do one more, Zechariah. To really get this, you need to read the whole context and assess for yourselves, is this what this is really talking about? We just don't have time for that. We teach this for, it takes several weeks of 3-hour-long classes to cover this in a good class like we have on eschatology, which is what this whole subject is. Zechariah, written a little after the time of Daniel, he says, it will come about, this is in chapter 12, just to get the time context, that in that day I will make Jerusalem a heavy stone for all the peoples. All who lift it will be severely injured, and all the nations of the earth will be gathered against it. So again, this is this international Near Eastern war that ends up coming after Israel. And in 14, he makes this interesting comment. Now, this will be the plague with which the Lord will strike all the peoples who have come to war against Jerusalem. Their flesh will rot while they stand on their feet. Their eyes will rot in their sockets, and their tongue will rot in their mouth. So pretty gruesome. But when you think about it, you know, if people die, their eyes rot and the tongue. And if it's not going to rot in your mouth, where would it rot? You know, it maybe seemed not that remarkable. But don't miss the crucial phrase right there. While they stand on their feet. This all happens before they can hit the ground. That sounds exactly like accounts from Hiroshima and Nagasaki. People just actually, the flesh flayed off of their bones instantly. And it's, yeah, could be, could be. All right, let's have a little fun. We're not going to take this. This is not the same as Scripture, but this is just me kind of imagining how this scheme might work together. Okay, so here's the Middle East. And apparently the first thing we noticed was that it seems like it's got started by this Gog Magog outfit, which would be coming from the north, and their allies, Persia, Kush, and Put, would be North African and Middle Eastern powers. They attack Israel. Then we read in Daniel 11:40, he will invade many countries, sweep through them like a flood. The beast, if he made a covenant with the many for 1 week, he has a treaty with Israel, of some sort, maybe mutual defense treaty. And so when Israel is attacked, this triggers the treaty and the beast attacks. Probably over his common borders with Eastern Europe. Also, probably every other way that you can come in there. And so the counter invasion by the beast and his powers. Then in Daniel 11:41, he will also invade the beautiful land. And so this terrible defeat that Gog and Magog suffer, where they are, describes the valley of Hamon Gog, which is just blanketed with dead troops. And, you know, he's taken on the most powerful entity on earth, the beast and his outfit. And so they break Gog and Magog. And there it's where, as in Ezekiel, every man's sword's against his brother. They basically totally lose it. Daniel 11:42, he will extend his power to many countries, and Egypt will not escape. So he winds up down there. And then we read in 11:44, but reports from the east and north will alarm him. So he's in North Africa. East and north would be back up toward Israel again. And surely this might refer, I mean, we're really guessing, we're reaching now. There's one other power block that hasn't come up in these readings tonight, but it comes up in the book of Revelation called the Kings of the East. And this is Revelation 9. You can read about it there. Release the four angels who were bound at the great river Euphrates. And the four angels who had been kept ready for this hour, day, and month were released to kill a third of mankind. The number of the mounted troops was 200 million. I heard their number. That is an amazing statement at a time when the entire population of the earth was probably not more than 200 million. And this is coming up in connection that this many fighting soldiers numbers 200 million. That must be billions of people on earth at this time. A third of mankind today would be over 2 billion people. Compare that to the 50 million that died in World War, or 60 million that died in World War II. This is, we're talking mega deaths, big deaths. And it says the sixth angel poured out his bowl on the great river Euphrates, and its water was dried up to prepare the way from the kings of the east. And so they gathered the kings together to the place in Hebrew called Armageddon. So this is what leads up to that in Revelation 16. So zooming in on Israel, this is where Armageddon is, right up on the north here, Megiddo, and then see that big pinkish plain there. To get into Israel from the east, very difficult, because this rift valley is like a half a mile deep. It's a natural defensive structure. So even though there might, and it says he will pitch his royal tents between the sea and the beautiful mountains. So he's right there. Even though people may attack from the east, it's probably from the north that the main attack would come, because that's basically the way to get into Israel. And that's where, boom, that's it. It says, yet he will come to his end and no one will help him. Yeah. Well, at this point, God has basically seen enough. That's it. It's now completely undeniable that the project of the human race to live autonomously and separate from God's leadership is a complete failure. Humanity is now on the ragged edge of self-annihilation. The missiles are probably already in the air. There's no way that people could say, if Jesus called an end to it, hey, we were just about to work it out. You know? No. It's not going to happen. And so Jesus is like, all right, that's it. Over. Pulls out the whistle. You had your chance. Now I'm coming back, and it's going to be my way now. So, it's the end of the world. War figures prominently in all these texts. And we might wonder, you know, what is it with the fixation on war? I think you could safely point out that humans kind of feel like we might have a few problems, you know, but we're working on them. We don't see the true extent of how really awful and broken we are in our fallen state. And you see God saying that our state is actually desperate. It's hopeless and awful. You see the fallenness in people when it's expressed in greed and oppression and God-tight systems that we create. But also supremely, you see the fallenness of people in war. Nothing speaks of fallen humanity more than what a bizarre thing to spend your time doing, just killing other members of your own species. There's nothing else like it on Earth. We're really in a category of our own. And the brilliance and ingenuity with which we pursue slaughter, it's fascinating. It's disturbing. We need to ask ourselves, what do you think is going to happen in the future of the world? You think it's just going to continue on pretty much the way it is? It doesn't seem too likely, really, especially when you think about some of that... some of those studies we were looking at, some of the ones we're going to look at next time out. Something's got to happen. Something is going to happen. And I believe this is coming. Where do we look for a solution? What's to do? Well, you read this in Daniel 12 tonight. It says at that time, everyone who's found written in the book is going to be rescued. That's the key. A solution here is not going to be a worldwide solution. It's not going to be a group solution. It's going to be individual. What you need to do is get your name written into God's book. It's the book of life. It's the one that they bring up in the book of Revelation. If your name is written in the book of life, you come in on the judgment day, and you come and here's God to judge you. And the first thing it says they do, they look and see if your name is in the book of life. They flip through there and, you know, they say, yes, there's his name right there. And God's like, you're in, go. You don't even come into judgment. Your judgment's already been absorbed by Jesus Christ at the cross. And so you pass out of judgment into life, as Jesus put it. They bring the next guy up. Oh, so you didn't want me to pay your penalty for you. You wanted to pay it yourself. Get out the book, the other book. They got the book of works. Every work, every thought, every word and deed you ever did that was wrong, recorded in that book. And so this is not a good spot to be in. Having God examining how do you look when it comes to the book of works. Be better to get your name in the book of life. That way you've done what he wanted you to do. You accepted his gift. And rescue is going to be afforded. We'll study next week, hopefully, how God is going to actually rescue people out of the midst of this before that last thing happens. And there we have chapter 11. Yeah. Yes, Lord, we do live in menacing times. a lot of menacing stuff around. Nuclear war is one of them. And it seems like the threshold for nuclear war is lower today than it was when I was a student with the Soviet Union and the U.S. Now we've got rogue states getting nuclear technology. Some of these are really crazy people, too. They could do anything. So we get the feeling that if things are headed this way, we really want to cling to you and God and your rescue that you've offered to us. And we know that you're going to get the last word here. There's comfort in that. And we pray that you would come quickly. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.